Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hey, it's Max. Evan and Aaron are not around. This is a special bonus episode of the Longform podcast. In addition to working on Longform, I also work at a podcast company called Pineapple Street Media. And in February 2017, Pineapple put out this show hosted by the guest of this bonus episode, Dan Taberski. The show is called Missing Richard Simmons, and Dan and I worked quite closely on that show. He has a new show out. It just finished its 6-episode run. It's called Surviving Y2K. It's all about the end of the last millennium, and particularly it's about people who thought perhaps the apocalypse was coming and did drastic things with their lives. Dan is one of those people. It's important context for you to know for this conversation. He came out to his wife right around the millennium in 1999. So anyway, this one is a sort of inside the family episode. Dan and I worked together really, really closely, and yet still there were questions that I had never asked him before. So I did, and that is what you're going to listen to right now. We'll be back with a regular episode on Wednesday. That episode will be sponsored by MailChimp, just like this bonus episode is sponsored by MailChimp, just like every episode we have done in 2018 has been sponsored by MailChimp. We quite literally could not do this show without their support, and I want to thank them. Thanks for everything, MailChimp. Okay, here's a conversation with Dan Taberski. How does it feel to be in the other chair?
It feels literally, I am literally in the other chair because that's my interview chair. You're sitting in my interview chair when I do interviews here.
Technically, you're sitting in my interview chair when you do interviews here, but...
Yeah, but in terms of, yeah, I feel like I own that chair and apparently I don't.
No, you don't. I mean, I literally actually own this chair.
I know. So second twice, you're going to really bring it home. I own this place. Yeah.
This is all.
It's all mine.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I think we just have to lean ourselves into the weirdness. That's my opinion of how we should do this.
I'm all about that.
I feel like I have on the long form podcast oftentimes like pushed the meta envelope. And I feel like today is an opportunity just to like knock it off the table.
Let's do it.
Okay. Here are some things I want to talk to you about. You and I work very closely together mm-hmm. and have for some time. Mm-hmm. There are lots of things that I know about you. Mm. And I've elected, I think, to not pretend I don't know those things and then ask you questions about them.
That makes sense.
But here's the thing that I don't know, which makes sense to talk about on the show, is how do you write this shit?
How, like, process?
Yeah, because here's my experience of it, is like, we will do an edit, and we'll give you a bunch of notes, and then you go away, and come back, and it's done. What happens in the dance space? That's what I'm...
The dance space is where I struggle. That's where I do my private struggling. It's funny because I really like I like edits. I like the process where people tell me what they do and don't like about it. And I like to think that I'm super open to criticism and that I want to hear... I really, really, really want to hear what people don't like. Because it's honest. Like, if people hear something and something doesn't hit them the right way, like, I want to know that. That's like great information. But that being said, I don't like, you know, sometimes we'll have an edit, like, you know, so I'll bring in a cut of an episode and we'll have an edit and somebody will type up all the notes, right? They'll type up all the notes, like everything that everybody said, and like Max said this, and then Jenna said this, and then Henry said this, and then Max said this. I never read that. I literally never read it. And which is a trick I learned, and I don't mean that to be disrespectful. It's just a trick I learned in that, from television, in that people give conflicting notes all the time, and you can't at least for me, it doesn't work for me to try to check off the notes that people gave me and address those notes. It's just about taking the vibe in the room and the collective feeling of how everybody wanted this thing to evolve and taking that feeling and running with it. And I end up incorporating a lot of the notes in that way, but I definitely don't. I don't do a checklist of like, here's what people want me to change. It's not.
Do you feel like you're like an accurate reader of the vibes in the room?
I will say this, my experience at least here is that when I have read the room wrong, I just come back and I've done the wrong thing and they'll tell me again. And I think that's okay too. But I do. I do think that I get a general sense of when people are giving me a note that doesn't quite have meat behind it, or they're giving me a note that has a lot of depth and is coming from a place that they're sort of incorporating a lot of different perspectives and sort of giving me a big note that I can actually chew on instead of just like, why don't you try this? Like somebody who can give a good note about what I'm doing wrong is just invaluable to me.
So when you get those the notes and then the notes that you don't read and then like the vibe in the room, what is actually like, how do you write these scripts? I don't know the answer to that.
There's sort of a first phase of writing it where it's more like structure, and the writing is crap and it's not supposed to be good, and it's just sort of connecting stuff. Because for me, the structure is like it feels like 75% of what I need to do. Because the things I feel like I'm interested in, especially lately, are things that it's not like one character where I get in this guy's mind. It's sort of like things that touch on a lot of different worlds. Like with Y2K, it involves all the things. It's technology, and it's the politics of the time, and it's conspiracy theories of the time, and it's religion, and it's my own story. It's sort of philosophical feelings of endings and beginnings, and the different sort of emotional things that something like a millennium will bring up for you. And I want to try to get all those things into like a paragraph. And so, but in order to do that, like you have all those big things moving around, and you just got to squash them up into a little ball, and that little ball is the paragraph.
That like clarity about what works for you and what doesn't work for you, where does that come from? Because Missing Richard Simmons, which we'll talk about, that was the first podcast that you did.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me, at least, like you had very clear ideas about how you wanted to do it, which was surprising because you hadn't done it before.
Yeah.
So like from a process standpoint, like you've done lots of other things. You're like a producer on The Daily Show and directed documentaries. Like, was there some moment when you realized that like the way that you liked to work was to go off and self-squash?
I think there's a couple of things going on there. First of all, I spent 20 years in television, which is collaborative to the point of pain. and sometimes it works wonderfully, but sometimes all the notes come from places that aren't pure and they don't really help. And so that it always feels like menacing instead of really helpful. Also, I feel like by the time I got to the point where I was making Missing Richard Simmons, I've been working long enough, and my career had transitioned enough that I was finally at the place that I 100% chose to be at. And I think when I finally got there, regardless of how it turned out, I just felt really confident that like, here's the story that I feel 100% confident that I can tell and that it feels important and that nobody else is telling the story. Nobody else wants to talk about this thing. And I felt like all the time and work I had in terms of leaving, sort of changing careers and moving out of television and trying to do film and then moving out of film and doing pocket. Like it all got me to this place where I'm here because I chose this. And I feel like if I don't do it the way I feel like is the most effective, like, what am I doing?
How did you figure out how to write for audio? Was it different than TV?
It's so hard to explain because it's also the first time I've written for myself. So I think when I started writing for audio was also when I started writing in my own voice.
Rather than like producing TV.
Yeah. So I've written for a lot of, I've written jokes for people. I've written scripts for a lot of people. And so I know how to do that. And that's a different thing when you're trying to write how somebody else would say something.
Mm-hmm.
But so when I came into doing audio, it was more that I was writing for myself. And so I think I just wrote exactly the way I would speak. And I think that has got me probably most of the way there. And so that was the new thing. Instead of like, how do I write without images? It was less that and more, it's like, wow, I get to say exactly what I would say. That's what comes out. And that was a weird feeling to like, it wasn't.
Must have been kind of like freeing though.
Super freeing, super fun. It was like really fun and fun. It was, I liked it. Just super like Christmas morning type like it was like super, it felt really fun, hard, but fun.
Were there stumbles in it? Like, I feel like I didn't see a lot of like the scratch work, you know?
Wow, I mean, I felt like there were a lot. There were a lot of versions of that, and then I got a lot of input that really changed the way I structured things and talked about it. So it's nice you think you didn't see a lot of scratch work, but that's great. You're ignorant. you don't know what's going on. But what was the question?
Whether writing for yourself, writing in your own voice, came easily or...
I think there was something about, I was at The Daily Show for 5 years and I would direct and write the field segments, right? And so there's something about writing those field segments that is so stupid and literally the dumbest joke wins. And I say dumbest in the best way. Like who can think of the most like non sequitur, like what makes you laugh? When I was writing Missing Richard Simmons, or at least finally writing in my own voice, to feel confident that like, if you have an instinct and it makes you laugh or makes you feel something, just do it. And then I would bring it into the room and people would tell me what worked and what didn't. And like, what's better than that?
One of the things that struck me when you started writing Simmons was you seem pretty comfortable like going for the joke.
Is that bad?
I have no value judgments. But like that was one of the things I feel like even in those early edits,
yeah,
like there would just be these like there was one that I remember.
Did it make it in?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good.
That was you guys were going to find like his childhood friend in Mississippi or his, right?
Oh yeah, we went to Mississippi. Yeah, we went to visit his like one of the three people who were still talking to him.
Right.
Who turned out he wasn't.
And. Like you go to his door and he basically is like, I can't talk to you right now because I'm too busy. And like the scene ends. And then there was just this one more line that was like, like anyone in Mississippi could possibly be that busy.
Oh, yeah. That might be a little much. You know, it's hard. That's where my head goes. And I will say I made a conscious choice going into Missing Richard Simmons. Like, I'm not writing jokes. Like, when I'm in the field, I don't write. When I'm interviewing, I don't write anything. And so I made a conscious decision that I was going to just rely on my own voice. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to censor myself. I was just going to say. I was going on this very real journey. And so that sort of thing came out when we were doing it. And so we started collecting all these interviews where I was just like talking in inappropriate times and laughing too much. And literally like making exclamations like, oh my gosh, when somebody tells me something shocking, instead of being professional and like listening there and realizing that if I talk over them, that I can't use that audio. So we had all this stuff and I like that stuff. I like interviews that are experience. I don't like to go and do an interview with somebody where I'm letting them, where they're filling holes in my script. And I'm just sitting there asking the questions and waiting for them to say the thing that fills in the hole in my script. What I want to do is go, they're opening themselves up to me and I want to experience something with them and give back to the conversation they're having and help them process something too. And so that means not shutting up sometimes. And so I made that decision. And so it made sense that in the script we would do the same thing. Just don't say what you're thinking.
You jumped ahead there slightly, and I do actually want to talk about the way that you interview people because it also feels different to me. But I remember, again, like just sitting in those rooms when some of those jokes would be there, and like we'd all laugh, and then there would definitely just be this like moment.
Yeah.
And I could never tell. It's so funny that I like have not asked you this before, and now I get you in this room and I can ask you. I could never tell whether it made you nervous. Like, it made you nervous to put those moments in there which were funny but also kind of made you seem like an asshole. On my way out, I'm just going to insult an entire state.
But here's what I'll say about that joke is that I, in the way I heard that, and I guess you could play, do you ever play clips?
Yeah, I mean, we can play a clip. Sure. I mean, I hope I got it
right.
Let's
play the clip.
I might have gotten it wrong.
What happened?
He did not slam the door in my face, which makes him my new best friend.
Yeah.
He was super nice. I think he was making excuses. He basically said that he just got back from Los Angeles and that he was having a busy few days and that he has to go pick up his nephew from the airport and just all this stuff. And anybody who says they're having like a crazy day in Mississippi just feels a little not true.
Okay, that was rude. My comment, not the bleep. The bleep was to protect his privacy.
He was making up a story, basically. He was saying, I'm too busy, I have to do all these things when he's retired. Like, I just knew it wasn't true.
Right.
And so I was making a joke out of it. But in fact, it was a useful observation. Mm-hmm. If as a documentarian, like, I'm observing this person is making up a story because he's uncomfortable talking to me, which is what turned out to be true. He ended up canceling the interview. And so I was giving you information at the same time, but I was also sort of giving it my sort of asshole spin.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I was asking, I wasn't like, not asking for necessarily like the justification of it, but more like, did it make you nervous to do that? Did it make you nervous to give it your like asshole spin?
Did it make me nervous? Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's not for everybody, but I know that now.
That's a thing I learned from that experience.
I've learned something. No, I also it's not for everybody, but it's me. And I also know that how far one can go and how I go like a modicum of that. Like, I'm not that outrageous. And so I may say things that are a little off color, but it's authentic and it's real. And it makes me laugh. And I think there's a real it's not a small thing. It sounds self-indulgent, but creating something that is joyful to you and makes you laugh, I think people feel that when they listen to it. And if they can feel that I'm emotionally connected to the experience, not just because I think the story's important, because I'm feeling stuff all along the way. And like, we are experiencing stuff. This is happening. And it just makes me laugh and it makes me make stupid jokes. And I feel like maybe people can relate to that and a lot of people can't, but that's okay. And I will also say that I think I'm pretty good at reading a room. And so that's another reason why edits are really useful, is that I see people making those faces. Mm-hmm. What is that emoji where people make the uncomfortable smile?
Like the grimace emoji?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. if you get a couple of those, and I start to gauge whose sense of humor I feel aligned with and whose I don't. And who, if somebody reacts really strongly to something, like I'm pretty good at gauging that in a room. And if I feel like it takes people out of the moment, which is not what I want to do, I just want to take them out of it for a second and get back in right quick. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't do that, then I don't think I would put it in. I don't think. And then, until I find one that really makes me laugh, and I'll do it anyway. Because then I still have that memory. Like, I can go back and listen to it. You can't. Like, I love that.
Do you feel like there's a gap between like regular you and like host you?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, certainly, the sort of narration is written, right? And I'm performing that when I read it. But I'm also not doing like 10,000 takes.
Yeah, that's a thing that the people who work on your show talk about that you don't know, I think.
What?
Most people have to do lots of takes. And,
oh.
And you do very few.
Oh, in a good way, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
a lot of people say you should try harder.
Yeah. No.
Like, that seems to come very naturally to you.
Yeah, I'm glad. That's great. But I think that's part of getting there is to try and if you the easiest way to make it an authentic journey for me, this whole thing, just of like spending a year on Y2K or spending a year on what I'm doing now, which is I'm pulling my hair out for and spending all this time on Richard Simmons, like if it's not an authentic experience for me, like what are we doing? Like it's and I get that the final product that I share with everybody else is important, but people, I get to spend all this time processing and thinking about this thing that I was begging people to let me spend time thinking about. And they're letting me do it. And I get to go and find anybody I want to talk to about this. And like, it's so, and like, I just want to impart as much as possible that this is happening to me. And I want you to hear this happening to me because it's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
So Missing Richard Simmons was a 6-episode show.
Yeah.
About the fitness guru,
mm-hmm.
Richard Simmons,
mm-hmm.
who you knew personally.
Mm-hmm.
had, I think the language that we used sometimes was like ghosted the world.
Yeah.
He'd basically like cut off everyone in his life except for his brother and a handful of others.
Yeah.
And sort of disappeared from public life. And he was like the most public person.
Yeah.
And the way that we made that show was we did the first couple episodes and then we sort of like reported and made it in real time.
Yeah.
And a thing happened with that show, which is that two things happened. One,
I won a Webby.
Three things happened. The Webby happened. We can go on a whole digression about the Webbies and my feelings about the Webbies, but I will not. So the Webby happened. The other two smaller things that happened were many, many people started listening to the show. Millions of people started listening to the show,
yeah.
And. The way that I've described it to people is like there's like something at the top of the maw in like American culture, and that for a brief time, Missing Richard Simmons was like at the top of the maw, and I have these vague memories of like looking at like just searching Richard Simmons on Twitter, and like it was just like a stream of thoughts and whatever. And so that was the first thing. So a lot of people started listening to the show. And then the second thing was a lot of people started having significant grievances with the show, and particularly like the ethics of the show and also you personally. And we there was an article in the New York Times called the show Morally Suspect.
Yeah, in the headline.
Sure did, yeah.
you don't get that a lot in the New York Times. It felt like they really went for it.
Yeah, it was almost personal. Anyway,
yeah.
The thing that I wanted to ask you about was, I don't know that we've ever totally talked about this because we were so in it. We were like making these episodes and it just felt so kind of crazy and intense and surprising. Like at least for me, the whole experience was so surprising. But what was it like for you both, that first part, not the Webby? What was it like for you as the show started to catch? And my experience, you can tell me if this is wrong, was that you'd been making things for a long time, like TV and documentaries, and it hadn't had something catch like that.
Yeah.
So what was it like for that to happen then? And then what was it like when it turned?
You're absolutely right. It was one of those things. I remember there was a point where it just started going up in the charts and the iTunes charts, and then you know we were getting some press. It was great. It was good press. Like we were getting good press.
Oh yeah.
But it was just press. It was press. And then we started getting calls from like Nightline. Like huh? And I remember there was a point where Howard Stern had called me. Or Howard Stern, it wasn't Howard Stern, it was Baba Booey, the executive producer of Howard Stern, who called me, which is amazing. And then I can say this. My mom won't listen to this. I had just smoked a joint. It was nighttime, and I just smoked a joint, and the Today Show called me. And they said, we're sending a camera over now. Can we send a camera over like this? And I was like, you guys can't send a camera over here right now.
Do you remember what you did next? Like, after you hung up that phone?
Yeah.
You called me.
Yeah.
And you were like, all right, man, here's the deal.
I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. You were like, here's the story. I'm incredibly high. I was just called by the Today Show. They want to send a car here. I think I have to tell them no.
Yeah.
Do I tell them no? What do I tell them? Can you tell them no? It was
sounds a little paranoid.
It was one of the first times I really heard you like unnerved.
I remember looking at my husband, and we were both just so amazed, and I said, "Oh, this is happening. That thing is happening. That thing where it's no longer in your control and it's blowing up. It's happening." You know, like Scott Rudin sent me an email. Like, what? Like scary stuff that I don't want anything to do with that. Like, it's scary. It's nice. It's accolades. It's wonderful. But you can. It is more unpleasant than it is pleasant, because the lack of control is just the scariest part. You can see the different ways it can go, and you can kind of see out of the corner of your eye the way people are writing about it. Not about me. Like, at first, it was just like people writing about it. As here's this new podcast. It wasn't like a review of the podcast. It was like, here's this new podcast. Now let's go, you know, let's send paparazzi to Richard Simmons' house. And so now there's paparazzi staked out in front of his house 24 hours a day. And like, and then there's like, you know, like sort of TMZ people are like joking around and making jokes about Richard Simmons. And so I don't want that. I mean, the project was like, I am in Camp Richard Simmons. Like, I fucking love the guy. I think he's really special. And so I can see it becoming that sort of thinner, flatter, more salacious version really quickly out of the corner of my eye. And so that's uncomfortable. And then I turned off Twitter, and I turned off Twitter and then I was in Los Angeles, and Harry and I were finishing the final two episodes. And I went, it was really early, it was like 5 a.m, and I was staying at the Standard Hotel, and I walked down to the coffee shop to get coffee. And I flipped open the newspaper, and there's an article saying, what was the headline? It was like Morally Suspect Podcast or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was in the New York motherfucking Times that supposedly I knew was ripping me. I think I read the first few paragraphs, and I never read the rest. And it was like, wow, that's amazing. And I didn't know what to do with it except put it away in a box until we were done.
That was what you did?
I tried. I turned off Twitter. I turned off everything. I stopped reading. My husband started filtering things. So I was just like, so he started reading everything. And he would tell me if something came out that he thought was like, I should know about. And so I pushed it as much away as I could. And then I pushed a lot of good stuff away too. So I started getting, I wasn't getting any positive feedback either. And so I want positive feedback, right? But there is no filter for that on Twitter.
Did you feel bad?
I felt bad for Henry in a weird way, because I felt this was driven by my vision of a story that I felt like needed to be told. And Henry and all you guys came along for that in a really big way. But when it happened, I just felt like this was Henry's younger, although he's really well established, but I just feel like he's a little bit younger, and that the first time this was happening, it was going to feel negative, and I felt bad for that. I felt him feeling that. And I just as somebody I work with and somebody who I really came to like, I mean, we're friends now, like I felt I was unhappy about that. On a personal level, I was unhappy and confused and also just, but I started, it was worse after it was done, because I was literally focused on finishing. And so I was sort of incorporating the thought that conversation was happening out there among the other conversations. But I was more focused on like, well, what does that mean for my approach here? Mm-hmm. So it was a little more just nose to the grindstone.
Is part of that time when you're like off by yourself writing, I think that these shows where we spend like an incredible amount of time and they're very crafted and we go through like edit after edit after edit, there's some tension potentially between the final product and what exactly you are like trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a little bit of a leading question because my experience of you is that the gap is small.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in how it feels for you, and whether it feels small to you, or whether part of the process that we don't always see is you like trying things out that then ring false somewhere.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, I will write stuff that I just think. I mean, there's tons of stuff that is false. And but it's so interesting that you're talking about is the process that I get to the closing that gap. Does that happen in private? When I feel like I literally do it in front of you, like constantly, like especially when we were doing the last episode of Mitch and Richard Simmons, and the edit process was useful there, not because having other people listen to my work and tell me what was wrong with it. It wasn't about trying to make me fit into some thing. It was about having gone on this whole journey and getting to the end and summing it all up, that people were telling me that I wasn't being myself enough. And it was a completely different, that's what it felt like to me, that people would keep reading me like, I literally remember being on the phone. I remember where I was in Los Angeles and I was talking to you and you're like, yeah, I was like, this is it. Like we did, I was like, literally, if I was a high five person, I would be high fiving Henry. I was like, we did it. This is good. We're almost there. And like, you were just like, it's not. And it wasn't because it wasn't fitting anybody else's mold of what they wanted it to be. It's because they didn't feel like I was being honest. People didn't feel like it, to me it felt like people were saying, especially Jenna, people were saying, you're not saying it, so you have to, something you're not saying. And I think people were being honest about that. Those people, you guys were helping me be closer to what to close that gap. That's what it felt like to me. I don't know if it was true or not.
There was one thing that I feel like happened with Simmons, which I feel some fiduciary duty to ask you about, which is I felt like you were straddling this line on the show between documentarian and friend and journalist.
Mm.
And I did think that a critique of the show that landed with me was that you sometimes used those roles to your advantage. Do you feel like what you're doing is journalism?
That I use what roles to my advantage? Like that,
like
I was
you were a friend when that was a useful role and a journalist when that was a useful role. Like you could shapeshift a little bit in the show.
Oh, is that a problem? Was that a criticism? I don't know.
That was a criticism.
Oh, who said that?
I don't know. Maybe that's my criticism.
Yeah, that's hilarious. It's like some anonymous blogger.
Max Minsky says.
Did I? Yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself a journalist. I've worked in journalism. I use a lot of the same rules. But it's, you know, I definitely consider myself more from the filmmaking documentary world where it's similar rules, but just more leeway in terms of how you tell it. I don't see why. I mean, that's my favorite stuff. Is again, like,
it's like blurring those lines.
Yeah, not even blurring them on purpose. It's like blurring them like a person. Like you're a person. I feel like I sometimes hear things. I see a reporter that's pretending to be a reporter. But I see like, especially with narrative nonfiction, especially in podcasting. Like very often, people are trying to divorce themselves from what they're talking about. And all I can think when I'm listening to them is like, I see you. You're a person, and I know that you have, and pretending that person doesn't exist and that you're just the voice, with your own, like acknowledging those biases to me, and acknowledging the humanity of the person telling the story and asking the questions, to me, that's full disclosure. That's like, that's what's going on.
That's about the gap too, right? Like that's about trying to close that gap between who you are in your life and who you are on the show.
Yeah.
And I also think that that's part of what makes people uncomfortable about podcasting sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, is that like...
But nobody said what you can do. I mean, even just saying podcasting, like podcasting is like, it's so many... I don't even call myself... I really try not even to call myself a podcaster. I try to say I'm a documentarian because, I mean, there's so many different types of podcasts that it's not even specific enough. It doesn't... Why would you walk into this place, podcasting, where the rules are still not a lot of rules have been written? Why would you walk into this place and just like, I'm just going to stick to the rules over here? That doesn't make any sense. Like, and it's, I'm not trying to break any rules. Like, I'm not trying to do things. I'm not smashing plates. Like, I just feel like to mold, to be able to mold yourself to the story you're trying to tell makes more sense than sticking to rules that don't necessarily make any more sense. And I think there needs to be rules for the way you tell us. You need to sourcing and respect for privacy and like all these things. Like all these rules are here for a reason, but there's that, and there's a line. There's a line that you shouldn't cross. But I don't see the point of not walking up to that line and looking over it. Yeah, because that's where interesting stuff are happening. And that's also where people are staying away from because they're too afraid of it a little bit. And I think if you approach it with a head on your shoulders and you take the time to, you can't just walk up to the line and be like, line, I don't care, and piss all over it. Like, to walk up to the line and it's just like S-Town. Like, he did things in that thing like that you can't do. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to dig up somebody's homosexual sex life after they die and splash it all. You're not supposed to do that. And yet, he does it, but he does it in such a beautiful, and I was mad in the beginning of that episode. I was like angry. I was like, is he really going to do this? And by the end, I was truly tearful at what a beautiful, loving way to honor somebody by literally a straight man trying to understand a closeted gay man and talk about that in a really emotionally honest way. But he earned that. Like, he didn't just walk in and say, who's gay and closeted? Like, what's your story? Like, he earned that by spending years following this person and having conversations and to be able to earn that ability to cross a line a little bit and then jump back to where you belong, I think is where beautiful storytelling happens.
Okay, so you had a chance after missing Richard Simmons. My experience of it was, and I was pretty close to it, that like you could have kind of done whatever you wanted next. Like there was another show sitting there for you to do, and the topic was pretty open. Like I feel like you had like something of a like creative blank check after that,
which can be perilous, right?
Yeah, and so how did you land on Y2K? Why was that the thing you did next?
It felt on deck while I sort of had a little juice to do what I literally what I wanted. I could fuck up whatever I want, like, and I understand. And so to try to pick something ambitious that I can't, it's hard to see what other outlet or medium I could tell the story in. The Y2K story was the one that has always been on my list. And it felt like I had just gotten done telling the story that ended up being a very personal story, despite myself often. And then at the end, I feel like I embraced it. And that process of self-discovery in the middle of making it was really interesting to me. And it felt like the space I was in and the space I wanted to keep going down. And so I wanted the next thing to be something that I had a personal connection to. And that I just wanted to spend the next year of my life thinking about, and that was the thing.
What did you want to think about?
You know, I wasn't sure, but there's a couple things going on. One, I just think there was always a narrative. There was something really funny, which sometimes I say the word funny. I also do this with the word stupid. That I say it and I'm not quite using it right, but maybe you can get it in the context. There was something really funny to me about trying to tell a story about something that never happened. And that's what Y2K was, right? It didn't happen. Like, everybody was ramped up for this thing and the world was going to end on January 1st, the year 2000, and it didn't happen. And I just feel like it's hilarious to... It's just a funny... it's a funny challenge. Because obviously stuff happened, and I didn't know what that was specifically at the time, but we spent $500 billion. People poured into Israel waiting for the second coming, and survivalists were stocking their bunkers with hamsters to have endless supply of meat. Like, all this, these things were happening, but they're all laughable now, and I thought it would be interesting to go back to that time before it became laughable and see what that experience felt like. And then connected to that, the second thing in that equation is that not only is it a time when something happened, when nothing happened, anytime people talk about Y2K, oh, nothing happened, it's always funny to me because that's when, for me, that's like the most important day in my life. Like, it is literally the moment where my life changed. I see before and after based on that. And I had never fully processed that because you spend a whole life processing something. But for me, it was something... It was undone. I wasn't done with it yet. And so I knew this was a way to sort of think about it more and figure out why I wasn't done with it.
Was the point to find some closure?
I don't know if closure,
like exploring the undoneness is one way to think about it.
What does closure mean? I mean, I don't know what closure. I'm not even sure closure implies. I never thought about it that way. I guess I think of the process, not the end. And so I felt like wrestling with this thing about my life a little bit more felt like time well spent because there was stuff I hadn't figured out. I this is so lame, but I can talk about this stuff on this show, right? People are going to give me a break. But I'm going to, like, it's about a moment in my life where, I mean, that I was literally still having wake up screaming nightmares about. Wake up screaming, like that thing where you're dreaming.
You mean like in 2018 you were still having wake up nightmares
about this thing that happened to me in the year 2000?
Can we just say what the thing is?
Oh yeah. So on January 2nd, it actually ended up being the year 2000. I ended up coming out to my wife as a gay man and walked out on her, and the process leading up to that was the process, and leading up to Y2K at the same time, it all got wrapped up for me, and that it was a rapture of just like emotional, like internal violence. Like it was just a horrible experience, and trying to figure it out. That's just my experience, not to mention how it was for her, and the guilt and shame and all that stuff. And I was still having nightmares about it. Like literally, where you in your dream you're screaming, and then you realize I'm awake now, and my husband be like, "What are you doing?" Like, and so, like, I'm not done with it. But I don't have those dreams anymore. I haven't had them in a long time.
When did they stop?
I would say at least 6 months I haven't had one like that.
Which is, like, basically when we really got into production.
Yeah. I don't think that's... I mean, I certainly think it wouldn't take a genius to be like, yeah, you're thinking about it all day. Like, I'm spending all this time processing it, so there's an outlet for it, as opposed to the dream. If I wasn't thinking about it all day, I would be dreaming about it. I needed some outlet to think about it.
You endeavored to talk to your ex-wife for the show, and she said no. Mm. When you decided that this is what you wanted to do, how important do you think that conversation was to you? Like, how big a part of wanting to do this was talking to her?
I thought it would have been more important to her, and it would have been a really satisfying, I think, conversation to have. Without disclosing too much, we ended up having the conversation in the process of talking about whether or not she would participate in this. We ended up having some conversations that we never really had because of that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, like it was all in one conversation, but it lasted a long time and it was really intense. Like I talk about these things as personal experience, like I kind of got some of that. In the end, she decided she didn't want to do it, but for reasons I totally get. Like she's moved on, she's married, she's got kids, she's successful, she's got a whole other life, and like, you know, cracking these things open on somebody else's timetable is not, if you're not there, you're not there. And so she's super supportive of it. Like, you know, I talked to her a couple weeks ago about it, and she knew it was coming, and it just wasn't something that she wanted to be in.
I'm glad you got to have that conversation.
It was really it was awful.
I feel like
good.
A load off my shoulders.
Okay. Oh, really? Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was it's the kind of thing that it was a long time ago, and yet you have those conversations and you're like, this was yesterday.
Here's the thing that I want to know about you, which I have not asked you before. Missing Richard Simmons, we got to this point at the end of the show. There was a lot of sort of like noise from the outside and narratively, I think, within the show that sort of needed you to answer why you were doing it.
Mm.
And I do remember like that phone call when you were in LA and saying like, you haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
And then Y2K, I mean, it's this like expansive story, and you guys did so much reporting, and it's like 15 stories in one, and we're all over the world, and the structure of it is like incredibly ornate, but at the heart of it is this crisis turning moment of your life.
Mm.
In both of those situations, it feels to me like you had something that was unresolved, you hadn't totally figured out, that like was pretty painful on some level. I find it so interesting and foreign and brave that your response to that feeling is like, you know what I'm going to do? Get a bunch of people. They're going to work with me on this for a year. I'm going to shine like a huge fucking spotlight on this like dark, soft area of myself, even though I don't quite know what the answer is.
Yeah.
Most people do not like spring up a large production apparatus around themselves.
Yeah.
No, that's not you. It's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, I know. It feels, yeah. Yeah.
And right. Put themselves in a situation where for months on end, they're going to come into an office in downtown Brooklyn, try and figure out what happened.
Mm.
Does that sound right? Because that's how it's felt to me.
Does that sound right? It sounds right. I would amend it a little bit. It's not like I'm like, Henry, come on and help me write my memoirs. Like it's me. My lens on it in these situations and in the next one too is what makes the thing. Is that it's because I feel like I'm seeing something that other people aren't seeing, which is what everybody does, right? Like if you're a journalist or a documentarian or a filmmaker, like you see something, you have a vision, right? But what I'm seeing is on the outside, but the lens is me, and to know that I've got personal hooks in the story, for me, I should hope should bring comfort to the people who I'm working with, that like I'm not just telling some story. Like, I'm not just telling, like, oh, look, here's this guy who got murdered, and we're going to pretend like we're going to solve it. But by the end, we're not gonna, but it's still a great story. Like, I want to do things where that personal investment is like insurance for everybody around me that I'm going to take it seriously. And that it'll be a story told, hopefully, with some emotional importance. So there's this, like, you could take my story out and still tell really, really compelling versions of the story, right? But hopefully my additional part just adds a little bit of urgency to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like to me. That's sort of what makes it the experience interesting for me. It is embarrassing to think about it that way, though. Like when you say put together an apparatus, you're right. Like you're asking people to. It is weird doing edits. Like
no, but I think you heard the wrong thing.
Oh, okay. What do you want me to hear?
It's no one here has ever been like, you know, it fucking sucks, man. Sitting with Tversky while he works this shit out.
Oh, that, I'm not. Yeah,
that's not what I was saying at all. What I was saying is, I talk to people on the show all the time who write about things that ostensibly have nothing to do with them. And if you like peel it back enough and dig enough, they're writing about themselves in some way. They're trying to figure out something about themselves.
Yeah,
you know, like. I did this interview with Gay Talese once and realized that like Everyone he had written about was like an Italian American man within like 6 years of his age.
That's
you know,
amazing.
That I think is a lot of what drives at least the people I talk to here. Is there's something they're trying to figure out. Terry Gross, talked to Terry Gross, and she was like, every one of these conversations, I'm like trying to figure something about myself out. But a lot of those versions of that are like much subtler and safer.
Yeah.
And I feel like you're doing this thing where I'm going to use some terrible metaphor, but like,
please do.
You're jumping out of a plane and you like don't know if the parachute is going to catch, whatever the thing is. Like, you're putting yourself out there and you don't actually know where it's going to land.
Yeah.
And for most people, like maybe even the vast majority of people I've ever met, that would be not just terrifying, but like a fucking nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And for you, it seems, a lot of the time it seems fun. At least you feel to me unafraid of it.
Yeah, that's weird, right? I am afraid of it, but just enough to put the fear of God in me, not enough to make me not do it. The weird thing is I find myself in an unusual situation where, and I don't want to say anything nice about you, I don't want to say nice things.
It's never happened before. It's
in
not
general,
happen now.
It's just not something I want to do. I find myself in a situation where I'm surrounded by people who are telling me to do things that, who are telling me I can. It's such a, it sounds so lame, but like there was I said, give me some money and I'm going to make this podcast and I don't have an ending. But we're going to get there, and we're going to start it with Missing Regis Sims. We're going to start it, and people are going to be listening to it. And as we go, then I'm going to figure out the ending. We'll see if we get Mr. Richard Sims at the end. Like, it'll be great. And they said yes, like, which is, like, I worked in television for 20 years. Like, the do you know the outlines that you need to for any sort of real reality thing? Like, you need to know what happens beginning, middle, and end. And you are filling in holes in the script that they make you write 6 months before you start shooting. There's nothing real about it. And I started Y2K. I don't know how it's going to end. I don't have any of your characters. I got none of your characters, but here's what I want to do. And everybody's like, yep, let's do it. And everybody just seems so enthusiastic about it. And I am too. And so it just, it seemed, it. I feel supported. And it just, it, like, if you're not going to use that situation to take a risk like that, like, what are you doing? Let me put it this way. I don't know what else to do if I don't ask questions and spend time trying to figure things. It's all we're all trying to do, right? Like, that's what this is. It's like you're telling these complicated stories because they touch you in some way. But if you're not changed by the end of it, then what was the point?
I don't know.
But the next one does make me unjust. Literally, it gives me nausea a little bit.
The next season.
Yeah, a little bit. But they all do. Like, it's total, but I don't need to complain to you guys about it.
Hey, Dan, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me. Are you kidding me? I listen to your podcast all the time.
Fuck off.
I really do.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. This bonus episode was edited by Henry Malofsky. Henry is also the senior producer on Missing Richard Simmons and Surviving Y2K. He led all of the production for both of those shows. And I'm very biased. I have very little perspective. But I am incredibly proud to be associated with both of those projects, even in the slightest way. And they are both a testament to Dan and his writing and also to Henry. That show is a partnership. And Henry is incredibly good at what he does. Our editor on Longform is Janelle Pfeiffer. Our intern is Tyler McCloskey. Our sponsors are MailChimp and Pit Writers. Thanks very much to them for making the show possible. We'll be back on Wednesday with one more regular episode for 2018. Thank you all for listening all year. See you then.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.